Yeah. Can you hear any difference? Okay. Okay, then, well, then actually you get that E, well, it's not isomorphic to rho plus column Hilbert space, but it's isomorphic to a quotient of a subspace of a rho plus column Hilbert space, which is not in general a rho plus column space. Of course, if you're just in the Banach space setting, the category of Hilbert spaces is closed under taking subspaces and quotients. And this is essentially in PCH-Lyachenko, except that we can remove an extra condition needed there, and the same story we call D. I don't think I'll spend time with that. Okay, I think I will, let me just briefly run over this. I mean, if you have, there's a splitting lemma, which is in Lyachenko's paper, that if a Billner form satisfies this F1 conjecture with a certain constant here, then you can actually split it into two Billner forms where you have this term on for the first one and this term for the second one. Actually, the way it was put in the paper here, they didn't get exactly the same states here. They might get some other states, but PC discovered later that you could actually stick to the same states, and that the proof of that actually appeared in the paper recently. Okay, but let's then say that if you have a Billner form on two C-stars, well, then let simply UER be the smallest constant you can have up here. And then it turns out, well, maybe I'll put it in different order because we later on found out to prove it in different order. Namely, it turns out that this, of course, this one is the solution of the F plus 1 conjecture with constant 1, and this one is fairly easy to obtain. So these JCB norm and this ER norm are equivalent. And actually, in this case, the constant 1 here and the constant 2 are sharp. And that's, I think that's the only case we know that they are constants. And let me take the other one, which is quite surprising thing, actually, that if you have, it's not that hard to prove, but if you have a uniformly completely bounded Billner form, that means that you have an inequality like this with the min norm instead of the max norm here, then you know that this is bounded by our main result, and in fact, then you get this for free, so you can exchange min with max here, perhaps losing a constant too. Of course, you could read this carefully. I mean, if this holds for all C-style by C and D with a min norm, then this same holds with a max norm up to a constant 2 for the max norm for all C-style. Okay. One more slide, and just some remarks on the Lyachenko approach. If one studies that proof carefully, one actually get out fairly easily in the case of operator spaces, you will have that this. I didn't define it, but it's obvious how to define this UER norm also for operator spaces. Then you will have that U satisfied such a F1 square inequality if and only if this inequality holds with the max norm instead of the mean norm for all C star plus C and D. And actually, for their proof, we had an application to operator spaces where essentially the deceased algebras here could be chosen so that they had the QF property. And the deceased algebras they have are actually the phenomenal algebras coming from free Arrhenius Wood factors. Okay. Yeah, I think. So now I'm talk about the proof of the new result. And it's based on commutative axiomy and power factors. So let me just recall this. Power factors you get by, they are injective factors of type 3 lambda, unique injective type 3 lambda, where lambda is between 0 and 1. The infinite tensor product of 2 by 2 matrices with respect to the sixth state, given by phrase class, this positive operator of phrase 1. And, you have the infinite tensor product state, and it's fairly easy to compute the modular automorphism group. If you take just of these omega lambdas on the 2 by 2 matrix, the modular automorphism group leaves the diagonal fixed and the corners are multiplied with lambda it and lambda minus it. So it's periodic with period, minimal period, both this one and this one is periodic with minimal period minus 2 pi divided by log lambda. I put in minus sign to get a positive number. Okay. This algebra, then, for this product state, you can consider the centralizer, namely the algebra, satisfying these two equivalent conditions. The second one is that the fixed point on the modular automorphism group. And actually, for this particular case of a power factor and this tensor product state, one can prove that the relative commutant of the centralizer in M is just equal to the scalars, and that's turned out to be very important for our approach. Actually, we need a strengthening of this result, which I proved in 89, namely, still in the case of, this was proved in more general setting of general free lambda factors, but in particular for the power factor, one will have that the strong version of the Dixmier property, namely that if you take a convex hull of u x u star, where x is an m, and u runs through the unitaries of this small algebra m phi, then you still get a central element, and actually there's only one, namely phi of x tensor 1. And of course, the difference between this one and this one is it's fairly easy to get from this one that you can do this in closed N2 norm just by Hilbert space techniques, but to get it in norm you have to work extra. Now from this you can apply standard techniques from Dixmier and get a corresponding Dixmier averaging process, so you can do this non-Ohmian one operator, you can do it simultaneous any finite set of operators, and so that means that you inside the convex hull of these inner automorphisms given by unitaries from this small algebra, you can find a net which converts to the conditional expectation of M on to the center of M given by x go to phi of x times 1. Okay, and this is absolutely crucial for the proof. Okay, then we look at the DNS representation with respect to this state, and then you have your corresponding Hilbert space L2 of M phi, and, well, I guess I don't have to repeat all this here. You do all the standards in 2 meter tracks. Actually, get the modular involution J, and which switches M to N prime, you get the modular osmorphism group, which is becoming implemented by delta to the IT, where delta is the modular operator. And for a particular case of power factor, or at least such pre lambda factor with a periodic state with this particular period, you can prove more than, namely, if you consider not only the centralizer, but these spectral subspaces defined by that you can move y to the other side by changing with a factor lambda n, which is also given by the set of x and m, for which sigma t phi of x multiplies x with lambda I and t. Then, of course, for an n should be any possible integer. Then M0 becomes a centralizer, and it's not by this periodicity of sigma T phi, it's not hard to see that actually L2M splits in the direct sum of L2MN phi. Or MNs are not star algebras, but I mean they are certainly subspaces of this algebra. So essentially MN, the MN sums up to M, but certainly if you take the L2 closer, you get a diagram in the Hilbert space sense. And all these spaces are eigenspaces for the modular operator with eigenvalue lambda N, and also all these eigenspaces are non-zero. And we need one thing more, namely that you can choose, in these spaces Mn, you can choose elements, non-zero elements, of course, such that 5 c star c is lambda to the minus n half, 5 c c star is lambda to the n half, and if you perform this, you get 1. So actually this, you could think of this as jc, j is multiplication from the right side of psi phi with the C star, so you could think of this as C psi phi C star. Okay, I think I'll skip the proof, but this is simple, absolutely simple to me to say. So you just have to choose any non-zero element there and then scale it with a suitable constant, and this pops up. And then we need one thing more, namely power factors are hyperfine, they're also injective, so they satisfy a lot of conditions which became equivalent by Kohn's Allen's paper from 76. One of them is semi-discreteness of efforts and lands, which in the factor case says that if you take the C star of M and its commutant sitting inside B of L2 of M is actually isomorphic to the minimal tensor product M and M prime. Okay, now I think I have all the preliminaries to give the proof, or the essential steps of the proof at least. So what we do is that we start with our Billner form on JCB, where well, I must have written somewhere that you have a Billner form. Okay, it's written up there. Let me just put it this way. It's a jointly completely bounded Billner form. Now I I extend it to A tensor. So this is the C star tensor parameter, A with the phenomenon algebra, M the power factor, B tensor, the coefficient of the power factors. And this is an elementary tensor. It should be A tensor C, comma B tensor C goes to UA, comma B, and then this scalar CD psi phi, inner product psi phi. And then I explain that this act becomes, can be extended to the bounded Billner form, and the norm of this bounded Billner form is less or equal to the JCB norm. And the proof is completely elementary, because you just have to use the fact that, which I had, is that gone? No, that's on top of the same slide, namely that it's basically due to this. So on this, when you perform linear combinations of elementary tensors, you can, on this right side, certainly change, get it dominated by something like this, and which is equal to the minimum tensor norm. So let me just. So you get that this, by the equivalence of these two norms, this norm in B of L2M and this minimum norm, you get immediately this one, so you can extend by linearity, and the norm of this Billner form is bounded by this constant. Okay, but then one can go back to my 1985 paper and say, well, this is now just a bounded Billner form, and then you know there are four states, two on A tensor M, two on B tensor M prime, such that this inequality is satisfied. And then the next step is that we want to change these states into tensor product states. And for that we need an averaging argument. And first of all, it turns out that by definition this U, maybe I should, okay. I think I will go one slide back here. So this is my U hat, and then the next one is that this U hat has the following invariance property, that whenever you take a unitary in the centralizer and look at the corresponding element in the commutant JVJ, then if you exchange x by this one and y by this one, the U hat remains the same value. And that's, again, absolutely standard to meet the target axiom to see this. It basically means that if W is a unitary in the centralizer, then it commutes with the GNS vector psi phi. And then you're done. Okay. So what do I do to make these four states? To make these four states over here to become tensor product state. Well, what happened is that using this invariance trick means that you on this side can, on all these states, put one tensor V, one tensor V star on the other side here, and for the G's you have to put one tensor V prime and one tensor V prime, or rather take the inner automorphism given of these. And then you use this averaging argument to see that if you average, take convex combinations of this corresponding to these alpha i's I wrote up before, and use this Schwong-Dixmier averaging process, you will see what is sitting in here will converge to an elementary. Say if x is an, maybe I'll put the line on. Okay. So if you look at a special case where x is given by a tensor c, and then you have x star x. Okay, you can do this for a linear combination of elements with tensors, doesn't matter, but let me just take this very simple case. Then if you start averaging, you will start averaging on the m part here, so you can exchange this with a star a tensor, 1 tensor v, c star c, 1 tensor v, and then you can exchange this. Well, there's a little trick. You have to linearize this by making this dominated by 1/2 times the sum of these two. But then after this linearization trick, you can make an averaging argument so that you can exchange this with the first these alpha I, 1 tensor alpha I, c, and this will, what am I doing? I should have, sorry. So you'll get a star a tensor alpha I of c star c, and these alpha I's will now converge to in norm to phi of c star c tensor 1. Okay. Oh, this was maybe, but I mean this is somehow the heart of the argument that you have. You can average, you have, by tensoring with this big factor, you can, and having this big centralizer, you can make this averaging argument and get these four states changed into tensor product states. I think I have them. I wrote a little bit more of the argument. I mean, you can use that 2 squared alpha beta simple observation used in the proof of the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality is inf of these numbers, and so by the original but with the effect you can take t's on these two first and 1 over 2 and the last two, and then you can use the averaging argument to get these fi hats and di hats have them changed into tensor product states, name where the first factor is fi is this fi hat of a tensor the identity, and phi is a given state. And in the case of the g's, you get tensor product state of this one and phi prime, where phi prime is the corresponding state on m prime, just flipping with j. Okay. How much time do I have? Yeah, okay, fine. No problem. Okay, and then you can go back to the original inequality by using this one once more and then to get the square roots back. So you end up having this result with tensor product states. Okay, and then, well, now I'm fixing lambda, and I just so instead I so now I want to see what happens if I take not just multiply any positive operator t and t to the minus one here, but just take these discrete subgroups of the positive real line and take infimum over that, and then it's not hard to see that you of course get a lower bound of 2 squared alpha beta, but you also get an upper bound depending on lambda. Actually, this is sharp. Yeah, I mean, of course, you could try to do this just by the. Of course, if you want a factor with a big centralizer, the obvious way was to look for a 2-1 factor with a trace. but it turns out you need some state which has a where the spectrum modular spectrum is non-trivial. So that will become clear in a minute, I think. Okay, so proof of the Poisson conjecture. So now I first take a fixed lambda between 0 and 1. I form the corresponding power factor and look at this particular constant, which is bigger than 1, but converts to 1 if lambda becomes close to 1. Now, and then I claim that if you have a jointly completely bounded Billingslet form, and if you take these states that we got out of proposition 6, and that's where did that go? So, if we take this fourth state we got out of proposition 6, then actually this Billingslet form, this U will, I mean, came out proposition 6 after we have constructed this U hat and made the averaging process, then this U will actually satisfy the F1 inequality, not with constant 1, but with constant C lambda, it's constant up here. For these particular four states, although you have to interchange the labeling of F1 and F2 to get things to fit. And the trick is first you, I said, and that's where you, that's here where you need to have a state with a non-trivial or modular automorphism group. Namely that you had from a previous result that but you're looking at these spectral subspaces for the modular operator, we could construct, for each end you can construct an operator C, such that 5 C star C is lambda to the minus n half, 5 C star is lambda to the n half, and this one becomes the geometric mean of those two, namely 1. Okay, so I can go. What happened here? It's too much wind. Okay, so if I now evaluate this U hat on A tends to C and B tends to J, CJ, for this particular C, I'll get by definition U A comma B, and then CJ, CJ, psi phi, which is 1. So I just get UAB. So I can go backwards and say that this one absolute value square is the same as this one absolute value square, and then go on from there. And then I know from my proposition 6, I guess, and this one, so I can put in what happens for when X has this particular form and Y has this particular form. And that's, of course, completely simple computation to just plot in F, get the tensor product state on the tensor product with F1 A star A times phi of C star C, etc. And now I know from, well, I just erased that one. From this second to last line over here, I know the values of these four terms. So I get this expression. And then I simply multiply these two terms together and get two factors together and get an expression with four terms. The cross terms have no constants in front of that F1 D2, F2 D1, and the last two has a constant, I mean, this one times this one will be lambda to the minus n, this will be lambda to the n. And now I use this simple observation in this limit 7 that if I now, I could choose that to C for every integer n. So if I now, so I'm allowed now to take infimum of all such integers n, and I get something from the next slide. So I take this infimum, and then I get this infimum over lambda t over all n will give the square root of this one times the square root of this times this constant, which was just lambda to the 1/2 plus lambda to the minus 1/2, which was by my definition of C lambda was 2 C lambda squared. So I get like this. But C lambda square is, C lambda is bigger than 1. So I could plot in a C lambda square in these two places and still have the inequality satisfied. And if I do that, I will discover I can put C lambda squared outside and get the square of this term remaining. And so if you take square root on both sides, you simply get the desired inequality. And of course, if you know that the Ephron-Squan inequality holds for any this could be any constant bigger than 1. If you know that it holds for any constant strictly bigger than 1, then a simple compactness argument will give that it holds for constant 1. So that's the end of the proof and the end of my talk.